On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The Bush administration calls the killing in Darfur genocide, but so far the world's only superpower seems powerless to stop it. 2 years ago, the U.S., Europe, and Africa settled on an African solution to the crisis, send in African Union troops to stop the slaughter. But that has failed. Earlier this year, President Bush spoke of deploying NATO troops, but the alliance is already busy in Afghanistan. And while prospects for United Nations intervention have dimmed, Washington is reluctant to get too tough with Sudan's leaders because it counts on them for anti-terrorism intelligence. So the slaughter continues. Now the violence has spread to neighboring Chad, threatening to make a humanitarian catastrophe even worse. Up next on Point, genocide and the politics of paralysis. And joining me now from N'Djamena, Chad, is Raymond Thibodeau. He's a freelance Africa correspondent for the Boston Globe. We're going to get a quick update from him. And Raymond, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
You reported earlier this week on an effort to topple the Chadian government of President Deby. What's the situation there right now?
Well, the capital seems fairly calm right now, although there's a sense of tension in the air. There have been rumors circulating that the rebels are regrouping outside of the capital and are preparing to strike again sometime before the national elections, which is slated for May 3rd. Although, of course, those are just rumors. And so everything appears to be calm on the surface, and yet there's still a bit of tension.
Mm. Raymond, will you help us understand how this unrest between Chad and Sudan intersects with the crisis in Darfur in western Sudan and the humanitarian crisis there that we've been hearing so much about?
Yeah, the crisis in Darfur, which is, as you said, it's been going on for 3 years, more than 3 years now, has spawned a number of rebel groups, and some of them are hostile to Chad's government, and others are hostile to Sudan's government, of course, and each country has been blaming the other for supporting these rebel groups, and this latest attack that you saw. Was being blamed by the Chad government on Sudan. What's surprising about that is that this rebel group, who President Idriss Deby of Chad is calling them mercenaries, not rebels. But I think what surprised a lot of people here was that those rebels or mercenaries were able to get so far, into the capital before they were actually stopped. And I think that really sent a huge shockwave throughout a lot of people in this country.
But are these rebels related in any way to the fighters that are causing the problem in Darfur?
Yeah, that's the big question. Who are these rebels? And I think as far as the press corps here, I mean, we're trying to find that out. As far as President Deby of Chad is concerned, these rebels are, you know, were recruited in Sudan, paid by Sudan, armed by Sudan, and so in some ways they're similar to the Janjaweed, which have been carrying out a lot of the attacks in Darfur.
Right.
Although it's difficult for us to say, who is behind this rebel movement. I mean, at the very least, I think it's true that Sudan has at least been a place of haven for these rebels. Mm. But whether or they're getting direct support is yet to be seen.
Raymond, President Deby of Chad has said, or he said at one point, I believe, earlier this week, that some 200,000 refugees from Darfur who have taken refuge in Chad would be expelled. Does that remain on the table, that threat? And if so, what would happen to these people?
Yeah, a lot of people were hoping that that President Deby would back off from making these threats, which are widely perceived as being designed to draw in the attention of the international community to his plight. He has since backed down from that, but one of the things that he was quick to point out, though, in an interview with me earlier today, was that so far Chad has been almost solely responsible for the safety of these 200,000 Darfurian refugees. And I think he's calling on the United States and the United Nations for more help in providing security. As he had said earlier today, it's difficult for him to defend his borders against a Sudanese-backed invasion and yet at the same time protect these 200,000 refugees.
Okay, Raymond Thibodeau, thanks for keeping an eye on this story and checking in with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Raymond Thibodeau is a freelance Africa correspondent. He reports for the Boston Globe, and he joined us from N'Djamena, Chad. Joining me now from Chicago is Bradley Graham. He's the military affairs reporter for the Washington Post. And Bradley, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Anthony.
As you've heard, we're going to be focusing this hour on how intervention in Darfur might take shape. But I wanted to turn to you briefly to sort of bring us up to date where we've been in Darfur in terms of intervention force and where we might go. First of all, if you would, begin with the African Union force that's deployed now. Who makes up that force? How big is it? And why doesn't it seem to be up to the job?
The African Union force intervened about 2 years ago. It consists of contributions from a number of African nations. They are now up to about 6,000 forces in the region, but they have a very limited mandate. It's essentially to monitor the ceasefire, shaky as it is, and this is the first time this force has engaged in an operation like this, and while they have received some commendable marks for even attempting it, a number of outside assessments have found a range of weaknesses in their command and control and operational planning.
And there are very relatively few of them to patrol a region, what, the size of Texas, I read, or the size of France. I mean, it's just a few thousand people.
That's right. They don't seem to have enough troops. They don't have experience in mounting an operation like this, and they have had some shortfalls in the necessary equipment.
So, Bradley, the Bush administration has now settled on the idea of helping that African Union peacekeeping troop with some NATO advisors. What does the president have in mind? How would that work?
Well, the idea eventually is to augment the African Union force with some kind of a larger force under the auspices of the United Nations. But that is taking months to win approval for and put together. And so the thinking now in Washington and in NATO capitals is to provide some kind of interim assistance, a kind of bridging force to the African Union contingent. And so what NATO appears to be settling on is dispatching what they're calling an advisory team of 400 to 500 troops drawn from the United States as well as other NATO member states. These troops would not be conducting actual field operations. They would be assigned to headquarters elements of the African Union force, providing assistance in areas such as intelligence, logistics, communications, command and control.
Mm. So is there a feeling, do you get a sense from your reporting, is there a feeling that this is what the African Union force would need to bolster up and address those problems that you mentioned earlier, one of lack of mandate, lack of sort of robust command and control and operations on the ground? Would that really make the difference?
The thinking is certainly that this would help, but it would not be a permanent solution. Military planners in Washington feel that eventually a much larger force is needed with a broader mandate. The thinking is that the African Union force would become the core of this new larger force that would operate under UN auspices.
I see. Well, you said that operating under UN auspices, at one point there was talk, wasn't there, of the African Union force handing off to a UN peacekeeping force? Is that still a possibility, or is that what you're talking about? Is this all related to that?
Well, this is all related to that, but instead of the African Union force withdrawing, they would become part of this larger force. There are a lot of sensitivities involved here. The Africans are reluctant to acknowledge defeat and turn over the whole operation to U.S. and European forces. The Sudanese government is resisting the idea of any UN-run force in Darfur, although they've already accepted UN operations in a different arrangement involving northern and southern Sudan. And the AU itself has appeared to be backtracking some in its initial request to the United Nations for help.
Mm. In the meantime, the killing on the ground is proceeding apace, and it seems like a lot of this is getting bogged down in this kind of negotiation and competing agendas. But Bradley Graham, thank you so much for your help today. You clarified a lot for us, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Bradley Graham is military affairs reporter for The Washington Post. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Samantha Power, professor of practice and public policy and founding executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning work, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Samantha Power, thanks for joining us. It's great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And from Kingston, Ontario, Major Brent Beardsley. He's a Canadian Army infantry officer currently doing research on genocide and intervention at the Canadian Forces Leadership Institute. Major Beardsley also served in UNAMIR, the United Nations Assistance Mission for Rwanda, before and during the Rwandan genocide. And Major Beardsley, thanks for joining us. Good to have you.
Good day, Anthony. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you both for joining us. We've got a lot of calls already lined up, but I want to get a couple of questions out to both of you first to sort of get the conversation rolling. And let me start with you, Samantha Power. President Bush has called this a genocide. It's been a problem that we've been hearing about, reporting on for 3 years. Darfur has attracted a lot of attention from American politicians, human rights groups, writers like Nicholas Kristof, who just won a Pulitzer Prize yesterday for his work on it. Seems like there's a lot of attention being focused on it, and yet it doesn't change. What's going on?
Well, first of all, I think just about everything that the Bush administration has done has come in the wake of sustained public pressure. So while one has to focus on what remains to be done, which is an enormous amount as the killings do proceed apace, as you suggested, I do think it's worth reflecting on the impact that political noise and this kind of sustained student movement, evangelical movement, human rights groups, members of Congress, et cetera, really sort of pounding on the Bush administration to keep focusing on this has made a difference. I mean, this administration did use the word genocide. Bob Zoellick, the Deputy Secretary of State, has been to the region and participated in the political peace process, I think now 5 or 6 times. Students are now working directly through universities and through the states to actually get their universities or states to divest from companies doing business in Sudan, which is actually really one of the only new economic sanctions actually that's sort of been applied to this government in the wake of these killings. So all of this is sort of happening as a result of political pressure, but there's no political pressure and no sustained interest anyplace other than the United States. So at the very time that the U.S. doesn't have either the troops or really the political capital to be involved itself on the ground, we've got all the activism going on here at a time in the African Union or in the European Union or in the Arab League, you know, where countries that actually might play a constructive role on the ground that have more legitimacy, there's almost no interest at all in this issue.
And so, Major Brent Beardsley, let me come over to you. How do we do that? How do we create more interest on the ground in these other countries to make something happen in Darfur? Or how do you perceive the problem?
I agree with Samantha with everything she said, and I really believe that it's a question of will. Will it being that sustained and determined effort to achieve an objective. And I think in this case, the objective is to stop the genocide in Darfur. And you have to build it one nation at a time, build that international will first off, and then within your own country, build national will. And that means getting to the public. And there is no medium better than the media. So everything that can be done in the way of just mobilizing media attention on this problem will in fact then mobilize publics who will then confront, as Samantha has described, with the Bush administration, as we're doing here in Canada with the Canadian government, and beyond that to the international community to make people like the Arab world and middle powers and NATO and the United Nations take note and do something about this situation.
Brent Beardsley, you were in Rwanda both before and during the Rwandan genocide. It must be awfully unsettling. I mean, beyond
anybody's concern about what's going on in Darfur. You in particular, it must be awfully unsettling to see deja vu all over again.
Well, it certainly is. I think the first part was in 2004 when the 10th anniversary or 10th commemoration of the Rwandan genocide took place, and the leaders of the world or their representatives showed up in Kigali to mourn and lament the failure to respond to the Rwandan genocide. At exactly that time, just a few thousand kilometers to the north in Darfur, we were starting to get initial reports of what was taking place, and it took 30,000 black Africans to die before the international community even started to pay any type of attention to it. And it seems that we spend more of our time in an academic and legal exercise of trying to argue over the genocide word, the G word, than we do in actually responding and trying to stop the situation on the ground. It was 30,000 dead at that time. Some of the estimates now run as high as 300,000. So I think any response that we have had to date has been wrong or has been weak or has been ineffective if the, you know, 10 times that number have died in 2 years and we still don't seem to be any further in stopping what's taking place. Mm.
Samantha Power, let me ask you about the idea of intervention and what's going on right now. We heard in the first part of the program the effort to beef up the African Union with some NATO involvement. Is that are we on the right path? Is that going to make a difference?
Well, the only proposal currently on the table is to dispatch a couple hundred advisors to try to actually, you know, shore up the African Union effort that is underway. What you had about 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, was a political momentum that looked destined to bring about a handover from the African Union to the United Nations, as was discussed. And this would have meant that more troop contributors would get involved from slightly more robust and more capable armies with better equipment. And it would also suggested that the mandate of the force was going to change from a monitoring mandate, conceivably, to a protection mandate. Well, just at the moment when we were on the brink of having that handover occur, the African Union countries basically balked, and they felt as though we were kind of steamrolling them, that they were being told that they hadn't done an adequate job themselves. The Sudanese government, for its part, which is, of course, a part of the African Union, went door to door and did two things. One, you know, convinced the Africans that that they were being humiliated by Western governments who wanted to Bigfoot them, but also made the case that Darfur would come to look an awful lot like Iraq if they weren't careful and if they joined forces with non-African outside forces. So lo and behold, in mid-March, the African Union decided actually to keep the mission in its own hands and came out and said, look, we're not going to actually hand off to the United Nations until there's a political settlement. And we're quite a ways, unfortunately, from a political settlement. So a lot of what the president is doing now and what the UN is doing in New York is a little bit of an exercise in smoke and mirrors, you know, try to basically create momentum around a NATO supplemental force, in this case a force of advisors or a team of advisors, and in the UN begin rallying troops from countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, you know, countries that would be politically more palatable for the Sudanese, and hope that by lining up that kind of phalanx of interest and support, that in turn then the Sudanese will have to wilt and allow, you know, a sustained international presence to actually supplement that which has already been on the ground with moderate effect over the last 2 years.
There's so many issues that come to the fore, and just hearing you describe this and lay it out, and I want to try to get to a bunch of them, including this idea that the United States' credibility in that part of the world is undermined by, I mean, you mentioned Iraq. So are you saying that the United States is seen, that this is seen almost as an effort an imperial effort, I guess, in that part of the world, rather than an effort to stop the killing? It's like here comes the U.S. again wanting to set up a base in whatever, in Darfur, and so our credibility and efforts are undermined for that reason?
There really is that perception around the world, you know, that this is just another effort by the Bush administration to whack an Arab government, an Islamic government, you know, what's new? I mean, that kind of skepticism. But I have to say that it's really important not to let countries that take that attitude off the hook. I mean, if they felt that their interests were at stake or that they had an interest in stopping mass killing, you know, that perception of what is motivating the Bush administration would melt away. I mean, to some degree, they're using that as an alibi for their own indifference. You know, it's entirely conceivable that they could see this as part of some ulterior agenda by the Bush administration and still cough up the troops or the police or the political pressure that is required to get Sudan, you know, to stop behaving as it is.
Mm. Brent Beardsley, from your perspective as a military person, what has to happen on the ground to make an intervention force to give it the kind of strength and robust qualities to actually make a difference?
I think first and foremost, Anthony, you've got to have that political will behind you. There has to be will coming from the international community, from nations, from organizations. If you have that will, you can achieve anything. But if it's not there, like we didn't have behind us in Rwanda, your response is going to be inadequate. You also have to have, a common approach to what is going to be the objective of the mission, what is going to be the strategy that you're going to employ. You have to have, I believe, in this day and age, a mandate from the United Nations Security Council, a Chapter 7 mandate, which authorizes you to intervene in the situation and gives you that legitimacy and credibility and transparency to what you're doing. And then you've got to put the means together. You've got to build a plan. It's going to take a lot of money, and people have got to be prepared to kick in dollars. You can't do this on the cheap. You've got to be prepared to use force. And that has to be carefully and correctly and totally understood exactly what that means, because there will be fighting, possibly limited, ideally limited, but nevertheless, there will be a requirement that the force have the means to respond with decisive force, up to and including the use of deadly force. You have to put initially at least a very combat, robust, capable force on the ground that's got a lot of mobility. We're talking a country that's the size of France. Mm. So you need to have air and land mobility.
But let me stop you there.
The most important one at the end is you've got to be prepared to take casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Young American are coming home every day from Iraq in body bags. If you intervene in a place like Sudan, then young Canadians and young Americans and young other men and women are going to be coming home in body bags.
The question that
is the reality,
right.
and how many of those can you sustain?
The question that I wanted to put to you, and I actually was going to get Samantha Power on this too, because I know that you've been to the region, Samantha, you've seen Darfur, but let me start with you, Brent Beardsley. Militarily, I mean, how much of a challenge would it be? I mean, I know it's a big region. We've talked about the size of Texas or the size of France, but is it logistically complicated to stop the kind of killing that's going on in there?
Absolutely. It is logistically complicated, but it's not. So is Afghanistan at the present time, and NATO is operating and sustaining a force in Afghanistan, which is one of the most inhospitable places in the world and is literally at the end of the world. So you've got to be able to deploy rapidly, and you've got to be able to sustain what you deploy, so that'll require an awful lot of airlift. There's not a lot of infrastructure, so there will be a considerable engineering effort, and you've got a huge operational area. That's one of the points that has to be really consider, that you've got this massive operational air area, so you're going to need a lot of aviation or air mobile assets and a mobility that can move you around. It's going to take a considerable size force. Some of the estimates, a minimum of 25,000. Some of the estimates have run as high as 60,000. But certainly, if you're going to get in there and do what should be done, and let's say that mission is to protect people, it's a human security mission, then you're going to require that type of very robust, capable force.
Mm. Samantha Power, you've been on the ground there. What's your answer to that question? I mean, your take on sort of the logistical challenge of getting people on the ground and actually making a difference to stop the killing?
Well, I think one thing that one should point out is that the AU force that is there and that has kind of mission creeped its way up to being a force of about 6,000 now, with about 1,000 monitors and observers, you know, has made a difference in the places that it is present. The trouble is, of course, it gets a call, you know, that a massacre has occurred, technically, and only has a monitoring mandate, but that still allows it to deploy to the scene of a massacre, because a massacre is, in fact, a violation of the ceasefire. And by the time it gets there, you know, the Janjaweed and or the rebels, regardless of who it is, you know, have disappeared. But where the AU has made, I think, a tangible difference, especially of late, is by organizing patrols in the vicinity of these large displaced person camps. And I mention this not because it's in any way enough, but because it does show you actually, A, that this force has not taken many casualties. I believe only, five members of the force have been killed over the 2 years. That's five too many, of course, and it does require countries who deploy troops to be prepared to take those kinds of casualties. But, you know, it isn't exactly an Iraq scenario right now. If you were to able to, you know, multiply the number of these troops and deploy them in the vicinity of these camps to ensure that refugees, people who've been displaced from their homes, could at least find personal physical security at the same time that they were able to get access to shelter and water and food, then what you could conceivably do is freeze the security situation in the hopes that then the political track can take hold. Now, in terms of that issue of whether this is a confrontational mandate or whether it is basically an African Union mandate just ramped up with a greater troop presence, I think right now, given that we're having great difficulty getting troop contributors to deploy in southern Sudan, where there's actually a peace settlement that has, you know, that was negotiated last year, largely thanks to the Bush administration, there, you know, there is very little danger. It really is a more traditional peacekeeping operation where you're trying to shore up something that has already been agreed to by both sides. Given how hard it is to get people to want to go there, it's very hard to imagine that you know, countries are going to want to make war to stop genocide. So I think building on a protection model and simply saying, look, the Sudanese have allowed this number of African troops to deploy. They claim to want this killing to stop. They claim to want to round up both rebels and Arab militia who are involved in mass killing. Let's, you know, get the diplomacy right. Let's peel away some of their allies in the Arab League, like Egypt and Jordan. Let's peel away Nigeria, South Africa, you know, some of the big heavyweight anchor states in the African Union. Let's peel away China. And once you can get some number of countries, you know, aligned around the idea that we need to ramp up the protection force massively, then conceivably you could see a more peaceful deployment and not the kind of war fighting, you know, that no country really right now seems to have the appetite to undertake.
Let's take a call from Ewan from Washington.
I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C. I specialize in the crime on in war crimes law, genocide, and crimes against humanity, that area of the law. I wanted to address a point that I hear repeatedly. It's this notion that we have to wait for someone to declare that there's a genocide before we have the authorization to go into Sudan and do something about it.
You're saying that it has to be recognized and declared as a genocide before intervention can happen.
I'm saying this is a myth, and I'm saying that it's actually false. You don't have to wait for the Security Council to declare there to be a genocide. Countries are not obligated only at the point of declaring a genocide to actually go in.
Samantha Power, Ewan from Washington, talked about this notion of declaring a genocide and that a genocide doesn't actually have to be formally declared for there to be intervention. Can you speak to that issue, and isn't it significant that President Bush has called this a genocide?
Well, the Genocide Convention, which was drafted in the wake of the Second World War, there was actually no word genocide before the 1940s, but makes pretty clear that the signatories to the convention, and it was passed unanimously in the General Assembly back then and then ratified by you know, almost all the major nations of the world, including the United States, quite belatedly, actually about 40 years after the convention came into force. But it makes it clear that signatories have an obligation to prevent and to punish the crime. So in this regard, Ewan is completely right that an obligation to prevent genocide means not waiting until genocide has already occurred, that you've already established that people are being exterminated on ethnic, national, or religious grounds. But I do think it's important to note that regardless of what the obligation is, ultimately, and Brent has made this point, I think, repeatedly, the real issue is not the duty as it exists in the law. It is useful that that duty has been enshrined and that states have committed themselves to it, but it's the politics of will. It is, you know, which country or countries, and again, I do think one has to go country by country rather than talking about the UN as a whole or NATO even as a whole or the African Union, but which country or countries are actually willing to take those steps to prevent, punish, protect. And unfortunately, again and again, we've seen that state upon state, generation after generation after generation from the Holocaust, from the Armenian genocide, frankly, forward, ultimately believe that their national interests interests are better advanced by staying away from crimes like this rather than implicating themselves in actually trying to prevent those crimes.
Hmm. Major Brent Beardsley, the political will when it comes to Africa, is that an issue? I mean, the fact that we're dealing with, we're trying to rally Western governments that are largely white to intercede on behalf of a country where that is populated largely by people of color. Do you see that as an issue in terms of...
Anthony, when I got back from Rwanda, I spent the last 12 years of my life trying to understand what happened in Rwanda, what we should have known that we didn't know, what we could have done that we didn't do, and why that mission failed, and why 800,000 to a million Rwandans died. And the conclusion that I came to, unfortunately, is exactly that, that we just hold Africa to a far higher standard of suffering and tears and blood than we do the rest of the world. We were actually contacted by an officer from a Western nation during Rwanda who told us that the casualty estimates were that 800,000 Rwandans were worth the life of 10 soldiers from his nation. And that unfortunately is the fact. Just look at Darfur. We didn't even know about it until 30,000 were dead. We've had whole periods of time, 2, 3, 4 months on end, where there's been virtually no coverage of it as we've our attention's gone to the tsunami or to Katrina or to the American presidential election. Whatever comes up takes it off the news. And that suffering continues at a horrendous rate. And it just seems to be that if there's a black face on the victim, we don't identify with it, and it doesn't seem to spark that moral outrage that it should spark to take some effective action or response to stop it.
Let's take a call. How about Nat, who's calling from Silver Spring, Maryland? Nat, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Very glad to hear you. What's on your mind?
The major problem we have in the world today is the political will. Take, for example, some time ago, Condoleezza Rice requested Congress to give some help to the African Union. It didn't go through. The African Union, they are there on the ground. They're willing to sacrifice and do everything to get the work done. Unfortunately, they do not have the requisite tool to do it. For example, the funding or whatever they need to clothe themselves in order to do the work. Mm-hmm. So sending on... United Nations force or NATO force is not the solution. People are there right now, willing to do the work. If we can support them, then things will get done.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that's not the case.
Nat, thanks for the call. Samantha Power, respond to Nate. Is this just a question of more political will and supporting what's already there on the ground? Is that a viable idea?
Well, I think he makes an important point in that we have to applaud the countries that have chosen, within the African Union, who have chosen to go to Darfur at a time when the place was on fire. I mean, when no other country wanted to step forward, the Rwandans, not by coincidence, the Senegalese, the Nigerians, you know, they stepped up. And I think it's really worth taking note of that. And as I suggested earlier, they really have, where they are present, they have actually constituted a deterrent of these militia forces. But we also shouldn't romanticize what this force is. I mean, it is a very mixed quality, as you know, by definition, armies on the continent of Africa are of mixed quality. Some of the soldiers are there. Again, I think many of the Rwandans are there because they don't want to see history repeating itself. They don't want to see another genocide on their watch. But some of the soldiers are there, the units are there, in order to take home a bigger paycheck because, you know, service in the African Union pays better than service in your home country.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the caller is also right, though. Nat is also right in suggesting that we haven't really revealed with our actual tangible commitment, with our actual training commitments, with our lift commitments, with our equipment loans or donations to these countries, an investment in regional peacekeeping. We have not really made that commitment. And given that Western countries have basically opted out of peacekeeping in Africa, not just the United States in the wake of Somalia, but European countries now want nothing to do with UN peacekeeping on the continent of Africa. They've made that very, very plain. Given that fact, with the exception of France, which does it for its own reasons, what are we actually going to do to ensure that the African Union can tend to its own problems, not just in Darfur, but in the very long term? And I don't think you've seen either from the United States, which has actually made a commitment to train 75,000 African peacekeepers by 2010, but it's sort of being done in a very low-grade way. It's not got high-level attention. Or from European countries that could each adopt a country and you know, take seriously human rights training, actual command and control, you know, enhancement, and, you know, the supplying of equipment that can make them more mobile and more able to step in to a vacuum like that exists in Darfur.
Mm. Brent Beardsley, I wanted to ask you, again, going back to your experience in Rwanda, what's the biggest missteps that can be made by the international community in deciding to do, in what to do about genocide, in deciding how to respond to genocide?
Anthony, I spent time over the last 10 years studying perpetrators, studying the people that plan and organize and direct and make decisions about conducting a genocide. And I've read their writings and listened to their speeches and in a couple occasions had an opportunity to interview them. And perpetrators do genocide for three reasons. One, they see it as a solution to a dispute or a conflict or hostilities that they have. They actually believe that this is a tool in conflict resolution, a tool that they can use. We thought in the late 1940s that we had taken that tool out of the box and had banished it to the dustbins of history with the Genocide Convention. But we haven't. It's come out many times, and it remains an option for some people today as they deal with those problems. The second one is that they don't believe anyone will stop them. They believe that they've been given a green light to go ahead and do what they do, and no one will have the will and the means to stop them. And the third point is that they believe they will get away with it, that the facts of history are that the overwhelming majority of those who commit genocide actually do get away with it. We've held very few or small minority accountable. And those are the three things I think that we've got to get at when we're talking about political will. We've got to convince the government of Sudan that genocide in Darfur, as they have done for the last 40 years in the north-south or in their handling of operations in the Nuba area or the Dinka people, that genocide is off the table, that we will intervene and stop them, and they'd better take us seriously, and finally, that they will not get away with it, that those who have ordered it or committed it are going to be held accountable in a court of law somewhere, someday, for the crime. And until we get those three things right, unfortunately, genocide is still a tool that some perpetrators will use.
Sadly, will still be with us. Let's go to Jean, who's calling from Boston. Hello, Jean.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, the Sudanese government and the Janjaweed. Actually, the problem is like it's based in Khartoum, actually. So you can see the even Arab helping the Sudanese government. And that's what made Sudanese people, like Sudanese government in specific, not really to allow the international community. And they're really playing a role with oil because China wants oil. And Russia have business with Sudan, with the government of Sudan. Mm. That's what really not allowing the international community because They don't want to support the intervention of the international community to intervene in Sudan.
Jean, you raised some great points, and I'd like to get both Samantha Power and Brent Beardsley to respond. Jean is talking, Samantha, about sort of geopolitical interests and political interests in Khartoum that may make it difficult for the United States to be as tough with the Khartoum government and other countries to be as tough with the Khartoum government about this problem as may be necessary. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're very dependent on the Sudanese government for counterterrorism assistance. Of course, bin Laden spent 5 years hanging out in Sudan while he was plotting his dastardly deeds elsewhere. We rely on the Sudanese government, of course, for shoring up this peace deal that we brokered between North and South, between the Sudanese government and rebels in the South. And we have a strong Christian constituency in this country who rightly drew President Bush's attention to this issue and insisted that a high-level envoy be deployed, John Danforth be deployed, and that peace process be given serious and significant attention. And so we've got to maintain that attention. And so how do you, you know, simultaneously, how do you walk and chew gum at the same time? How do you punish the Sudanese government, pressure the Sudanese government so it stops its murderousness in Darfur, while also, actually offering the Sudanese government enough carrots so that it gives us the cooperation we want vis-a-vis Southern Sudan and counterterrorism? The other countries that the caller mentioned, I think, are even supply even more dramatic examples of national interest cutting in favor of abetting genocide. China now is in an ideal situation because the United United States government has sanctions imposed against Sudan, so U.S. companies can't do business there, which frees up this entire, you know, oil prospecting bounty for Sudan, for China, and indeed for France to take advantage of. So to some degree, this is, you know, China not only has an interest in cozying up to the Sudanese government, but actually has an interest to cozying up and continuing to see the United States, trying to be tough with that government.
Brent Beardsley, respond, though. I mean, Samantha Power posed a great question. How do you, what do we do? I mean, how do you do that? How do you juggle these competing interests? On the one hand, we want to stop the killing in Darfur, but there are these huge, sprawling global interests with tentacles that go from Beijing to Washington to Khartoum, and it's a complicated world.
It is, in fact, but I think there is one key to it, and that is that within the government of Sudan, there are a group of people who have power who can stop this thing in a very short period of time. This is not some sort of spontaneous conflict or there's militias that are out of control. This is definitely a planned and organized, and it's a controlled operation. So you've got to convince those individuals to stop what they're doing. And quite frankly, the government of Sudan does not take us, does not take the international community seriously. And why should they? For over 40 years, they have been doing the same type of thing in the North-South conflict, in the Nuba Mountain region against the Dinka people, and now turning their attention onto Darfur, and it's always been the same. We have some sanctions, maybe some restrictions, some embarrassing UN deliberations, some reports, some media coverage, and then the world gets bored of the situation and turns away. So why should our protests, why should our threats at this point convince them differently? Because they just don't take us seriously. Mm. And one of the points that we've got to get through to the government of Sudan is that this time you're going to take us seriously. Now, we're going to have to prove that. And if we don't, if it just turns into more conferences, more discussion, more talk, more reports, then the government of Sudan can just carry on the way it has for 40 years. If we want to change their behavior, then there's going to have to be something very decisive done to convince them that this time we're serious and you've got to start changing your behavior.
Let's try to get one more call into this conversation. Ginny is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hi, Ginny.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank Ms. Powers for the work she's doing. She's my hero. Secondly, I'd like to say that I'm a student at Eastern Michigan University, and we're currently trying to do some advocacy work for the people of Darfur. Primarily, next week, we're working on a letter-writing campaign, and I would like to know specifically what type of things should we include in our letters, and to whom should we address those letters to, so that we can be as effective as we possibly can be.
Samantha Power, we have about a minute left, but it sounds like Ginny has a very useful and practical question that you could help her with. And besides, you're her hero, so you should answer.
Well, thank you, Ginny. I mean, as I said at the beginning of the program, I think the students have done more than just about any other constituency in this country to keep Darfur literally alive. And indeed, even the divestment campaign now, which is the one sanction against China, which is, again, a country that's been able to continue to do business, I think is a very, very encouraging movement. To your question, it's essential, I think, that a high-level envoy be appointed to try to help broker this political settlement. The candidate that I think would be ideal, given how much regret he has expressed over Rwanda, is President Clinton. And obviously, President Bush probably wouldn't be appointing Clinton, but Kofi Annan could do so under UN auspices, as he did for tsunami relief. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is really pushing forward on tripling the number of protection forces on the ground and getting the U.S. Congress to be willing to pay for that, to be willing to equip it, to get those advisors in there to oversee the handover. That is what is most urgent because people are dying as we speak.
Samantha Power, thank you so much for joining us today on this difficult and important subject. And Major Brent Beardsley, thank you too.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Samantha.
Samantha Power is Professor of Practice and Public Policy and Founding Executive Director at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She joined us from Washington. And Major Brent Beardsley, Canadian Army Infantry Officer who served in the Canadian Forces for 28 years. He's currently a research officer at the Canadian Forces Leadership Institute and writing a thesis on genocide and intervention. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.